Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Katrina's in the house. It's really, the crack has started.
Open the windows.
Absolutely open all the windows and doors. Do you know what, Katrina? It's great to have you along and for the regular family and parenting slot. And I love the title of this week's, Teaching Your Children Social Skills.
Yeah.
Now, can I just say, I only have two of them, right? One of them, I feel like I didn't have to do anything. She just figured out how to do it on her own. The other fella, you could be teaching him.
I know.
Until he
is there anything going in at all, you know? I remember my mother, God rest her soul, coming to pay me a visit, and she told me in a stunned voice how proud she was of me as to how tidy I was, you know. I said, Mom, I have two kids, you know. When you are the one who has to pick up all the towels all the time, you suddenly realise there must be a better way to do this.
That's right. I'm sure it was very validating all the same coming from your mom.
Exactly.
Absolutely. So yep. Listen, we are talking about teaching social skills. And by the way, Nisha, if you're listening, you're not because you're in school, but, you know, I was only joking. You're a really lovely, lovely child.
And all I assumed you were talking
almost almost 18 now, actually. He's doing
Yeah.
But so tell me.
Okay, so obviously, none of us can ever do what we're never taught.
Yeah,
okay?
Exactly, yeah.
So I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Jungle to Jungle. Tim Allen is in it.
It's
funny. And it's kind of like a Tarzan coming to New York type of thing.
Yeah.
And he's a younger kid, and at one stage he's in a hotel, he sees lots of ferns and plants and all that sort of stuff in pots, and he walks over and proceeds to urinate, you know, into one of the plants, you know.
Exactly. And that's what we did in the jungle.
Of course, everybody is horrified, you know. And his father says, what do you think you're doing, you know? And he kind of looks at him as the boy looks at him and says, well, what do you think I'm doing, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, clearly, he knew nothing about bathrooms and all that sort of stuff.
He didn't know any better, God love him.
Exactly. So please don't be astonished when your children, regardless of what age they are, do not behave as you would like them to behave if you have never actually sat them down and talked to them, particularly teenagers, about what you expect. Mm. All right? Now, it's easier with younger children, obviously, because you can do more disciplining in a more hardened way.
Plus they understand what the discipline is about, I presume.
Exactly. I mean, I know at one stage I used to think, we will never go out for a meal ever again, because this particular child of ours will not sit down.
Okay.
He just would not sit down.
Yeah.
And I mean, the echo that went around our house all the time was sit properly. And just thought, that's it. We will never go out for a meal again because we could never bring him anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, now it did eventually come, of course, but there was a time when we kind of said, okay, well, you know, it's McDonald's all the way, because we couldn't have brought him anywhere where you were supposed to sit in between courses,
And kind of at what point did he start figuring out?
Okay, well, the thing of it is, what point did he start figuring it out? Well, you know,
is,
I'm not exactly sure. He might. No, he's not. Thank God, he's not, because he loves his food. You know, he sits down and shovels. Maybe when he could join in the conversation.
Okay.
You know, because it can be tremendously boring for younger children, and especially if you're down towards the end of the family.
Yep.
Because the older children are chatting away, and you're utterly ignored.
Yep.
So you know, the whole process of trying to bring the person into the conversation is very, very important. Adler, one of the famous child psychologists, he had a notion, never do for a child what you believe they can do for
themselves.
Okay. Now that the believe are, well, he actually says what they can do for themselves, but we in society tend to say, well, by the age of 2.5 you should be going to the bathroom, and by the age of 4 you should be doing up your coat and blah 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 blah. And but you know, some of us, I know many adults, and they still can't do the social skills. Now for older children, obviously, I'm not talking about buttoning up your coat and sitting quietly and not interrupting and all that sort of stuff. I'm talking about respect and honor, you know, because that's what an awful lot of good manners is, is trying to be aware that there are other people in the room, there are other people contributing to this conversation, and everybody is has a right to be respected and to be honored, unless they're not being, you know, respectful and being honorable themselves, and then you as a parent need to remove them from the room, which is what the kind of the rule of thumb we used to have, especially when they were younger. And I've gone through, I've mentioned this kind of thing before. So one of the things we definitely used to do was prior, you know, you practice at home. And so you encourage your children, you teach your children, you discipline your children that they don't walk on furniture, they don't put feet up on couches, you know, that, that sort of stuff. And the way you would like them to behave in somebody else's house, obviously you're going to get them to do that in your own house. So that when they go to somebody else's house, they are just going to do like jungle to jungle. They're just going to do what they always do. And if you don't have a problem with your children personally walking all over your furniture, with dirty shoes, then that's what they're going to do when they go to somebody else's house. And you can't, and if they're going to pick up all the things off the table and throw them on the floor, you know, if they're, if they do that at home, then that's what they're going to do in somebody else's house. So you need to have a plan. You need to have it practiced. And you also need to put something in place, a consequence in place. Now, listen up here. That you are not afraid to implement. And that
through,
you will implement. Okay?
Absolutely.
And the golden one for us always used to be, we're going to go and to Mrs. Brown's house. Okay? Or your Auntie Kate or wherever. Okay? Now, you know what I'm expecting of you, you know, this, this, that, and the other.
Very good.
And if you do not do that, we will leave. Okay? So that, and I remember doing it, and it was, you know, there was skin and air
flying,
you know? But as soon as I, no, you're not allowed to do that, you know? And if you do that again,
that's gotta
we
be
are going. We are going. And do you know what, Ronan? I see it all the time. Parents do not follow through. And I'm telling you, you are sowing a harvest for yourself that is going to come back and bite you know where, and it's not going to be very nice.
Do you know, it's funny, you're saying it to me, and I can actually picture many times, but one particular time very, very recently, somebody standing there talking to their child, ineffectual, you know, standing there in the supermarket going, now, I'm getting very cross now. I'm getting really cross now. I'm going to, you know, I don't like this at all. You know, and like the child going absolutely bananas. And they're just standing there telling them that they're getting very cross and annoyed. And now I'm getting hurt now on top of everything else. And it's just like,
I know the child is going, I really, you know, couldn't give a rashes, you know, if you're hurt or not. And I hear it all the time. I hear parents saying, you're not allowed to do that. Don't do that. If you do that again, I will.
Absolutely.
And the child does it again immediately. And is anything done? Absolutely not. Okay? And so you are teaching your children, what you have taught your children is, at the bottom line, I'm not trustworthy.
Yeah, that's right.
My word is not my bond, you know? And if I can't be trusted in this, I won't be trusted in anything. So when you tell them that you will do something positive or even negative, they're not going to believe you. They are not going to believe you. So bite the bullet, pack them up, say, I'm very sorry, Mrs. Brown. I'm very sorry, Aunt Jane. This was a lovely visit, but unfortunately, Peter is not behaving himself, and I told him that if there was misbehavior, we would have to leave. Now, of course, you have this set up with Auntie Jane, Uncle Simon, Mrs. Brown, whoever it is, and you let them know that we are in the middle of a education here, whatever you want to call it, a discipline, you know, whatever. Yeah. And if my children disbehave, if Michael disbehaves, I'm gonna have to go. And I just want to know, is that okay? I'm telling you, if you do that once, twice at the most, that's the end of it. They know that if they do it, there will be no messing. The same with our teachers. Okay, yeah. It's the same as the fella said. It's the same, only different. You know, you know that. Now, obviously, you're going to sit down and you're going to discuss things with your teenagers. Yeah,
you can reason with them.
You can reason with them, but you have to put down your rules. Now,
I was going to say to you, remember, of course, that if you've been doing this since they were small children, they know that your word is your bond. They know that, you know, you're effectively going to follow through. So actually, they don't. You don't even have to have that conversation with them.
Yeah, you don't. But it may be that when you're on new ground, they're willing to kind of, you know, kind of wiggle here or wiggle there. You know,
that's their job.
They're pushing the boundaries. They're pushing the boundaries. Yeah. And, you know, that's okay. Because sometimes our boundaries need to be pushed a wee bit. Because we just, I know, I used to be pretty unreasonable in some things. And I needed to kind of say, well, you know, maybe I'm just holding the reins a little bit too tight. Now, I'm not saying, you know, let go of the reins. You've got to decide for yourself what's the best thing to do. But I can think, I know of one example off the top of our head, on top of my head. I remember one of our children having friends in and all that sort of stuff, you know, and I said, okay, I'll leave it to it, everything. I said, but this is what I expect as regards before, during and after. Tidying up being one of the things, know, that if you have, and I said to them, I said to them, when I invite my friends in for dinner or whatever, I do not expect you to come down in the morning and tidy up after us.
Exactly.
So I do not expect to come down in the morning and have to tidy up after your friends.
Yeah.
Okay. You do not go to bed until the tidy up is done.
Yeah,
it is not acceptable for you to come down in the morning and say, I'll tidy it up in the morning.
Yeah.
That's not going to work because I'm up the next day
and
on my normal routine.
To do their thing here.
There you go.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what happened? I came down the next morning and the place was like a bomb. Like a bomb. I'd love to say it was pristine.
It
most certainly was not. Yeah. So as the fella said, we had a conversation. We had a conversation.
I'm saving.
And you know, it was until you can convince me that you understand and you are going to do what I said, there will be no more of these soirees.
Yes.
You know? That's and fair. So there was an embargo on the soiree, and there was absolutely, I don't believe you're doing this to me. How could you do this to me? Oh my goodness, I'm ringing Childline. You know? And, you know, I can say, look, we had an agreement and you broke the contract, you know?
Absolutely.
And so they know your word is your bond. So every child is different. Every teenager is different. So you need to decide for yourself what is going to make your life acceptable and livable. And make sure you pass that information on to your children.
Because
you can't blame them for what they don't know. So the next time Johnny starts tinkling in the bushes.
Yes, that's right. You've been saying,
you tell him about the bathroom?
Don't do that at home. Okay. Listen, thanks a million, Katrina. God bless you. Always
God bless.
Great chatting. Thank you. Now, Dr. Anthony Levitino is an obstetrician gynecologist who used to carry out second trimester and late-term abortions in his clinic in New York State. He later abandoned this work when the death of his young daughter, Heather, led to him having a change of heart about the procedures he was doing. We played an interview with Dr. Levitino a couple of weeks ago about the film Unplanned, which is currently screening in Irish cinemas. And while doing that interview, our own Steve Johnson also talked to Dr. Levitino about the Irish situation with the introduction of abortion into our health system in January. And Steve is in audio to tell us more. First of all, Steve, what did you talk to Dr. Levitino about?
Well, I knew that he has experience of the abortion regime in the US, having worked there, you know, in it for a number of years. But
sure.
I also knew that he had some familiarity with the Irish situation, given that he had been invited to speak, and he came to Ireland to speak in the Citizens' Assembly in the run-up to last year's referendum.
That's right, yeah.
So I just thought it was a great opportunity to ask him a couple of questions.
Mm.
And so conscious of the change in culture in the Irish health system arising from last year's abortion legislation, I asked Dr. Levitino what he would say to young doctors and medical students in Ireland now, you know, who might be concerned about their future careers, that their careers might be limited if they express conscientious reservations to being involved in abortions. And this is what he had to say.
Boy, that's a sticky subject. We see that to some degree here. It depends. Of course, there are hundreds of programs in which medical students ultimately become residents and get trained in obstetrics and gynecology, as well as now other programs. Remember, with medication abortions, you don't have to be an obstetrician gynecologist to get an abortion. Anyone who can write a prescription can do an abortion. And there are some medical students in some programs who are subjected to a lot of pressure to perform abortions. There's even something called the Ryan Project in our country, which is specifically funded to encourage students and residents to get involved in the abortion industry. The American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology that creates our training programs and certifies our training programs, in January of this year just created a new specialty called complex family planning. This is a euphemism for training late term abortionists. So some students definitely do run into pressure. I would say to students, stick to your principles. It's a shame that abortion now is legal in Ireland. I spoke before the Citizens Assembly. I understand the process that you all went through. But it's still new. And I think it's important for doctors, particularly important for doctors, to express what they think of the issue and encourage young physicians to just plain stay away. It's an interesting thing. As I said, I did abortions. My daughter died. That's what encouraged me to stop doing abortions. But I know a lot of doctors in the United States who were just as dedicated as I did, who ultimately left the abortion industry, just got to a point where they just had a belly full of killing. No one goes to medical school to learn how to kill. But that's exactly what this is.
That's a powerful statement. I was just thinking something very similar. Like, you don't go in to, and particularly going into gyne-obs, you don't go into that. You go into that to bring life.
Yeah,
don't you?
Yeah.
You know, even the fact that, you know, people said, I went to the gynecologist because nobody's really sick most of the time. You know, mostly it's pretty happy, you know.
As you remind me, for many years ago, I worked as an orderly when I was a student in Lochinstown Hospital. Yeah. And I had a maternity wing at the time. Yeah. And I just thought that it was the happiest place in the hospital. It was
good
just
point.
Lovely. Everyone was smiling.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a lovely place to be. So, place to work.
Absolutely. Can I just ask you a question around that? Like, he obviously talked about, you know, students, and that's no doubt, you know, the students are going to have, you know, issues around, and they have their value system, and they don't want to, you know, nobody goes into it to kill. But, you know, I'm just thinking about when you've got your, you know, when you've got your training done, and then it's time for you to go and get a job. That's where I think you could really run into trouble, couldn't you? Because then all it needs is one question in an interview going, would you be prepared to do an abortion?
Yeah.
If the answer to that is no, then, you're kind of excluding yourself from that job.
Is it a career-limiting decision?
Yeah.
And I think it's just a really burning question at the moment. I remember actually him being interviewed before, and he was said, you know, that, you ask people in the street, you know, what's their view on, you know, are they pro-life or pro-choice? And it doesn't really matter what the answer in a way, but when he says when you're a doctor,
it makes a massive difference.
It's real. It means you've actually got to do something, you know.
Yeah,
and so when he went into it, and he considered himself pro-choice, so he did choose to carry out abortions. But he also said something there, just plain stay away, and his advice to young doctors. And that's problematic enough. And later on in the interview, you'll hear me, I suppose, bringing that up in a slightly different way. But I also just talked about him. I was interested, you know, given his experience, you know, he has a career obstetrician gynecologist, you know, about talking to him, picking his brains on the risks in pregnancy. I was conscious that perhaps most people who voted yes in last year's referendum did so because they were concerned for the safety of women in pregnancy. So I asked him what he would say to them. I thought his response was interesting. It was nuanced, you know, and it was quite measured.
Well, that becomes another controversial point. Elective abortion is one thing. And when this is promoted, we always hear about the, quote, hard cases. What if a woman is raped? What if she's pregnant as a result of incest? I could talk about this for an hour, and we don't have the time. But I will tell you, in my personal experience, during my practice, I performed just under 1,200 abortions in private practice after my training. And we very carefully counseled our patients ahead of time. Remember, we were in a private practice. We were not part of Planned Parenthood. We weren't part of a clinic. And I never wanted to be in a position where I was doing an abortion on someone who was being forced or coerced in some way. So we very carefully spoke with our patients and understood what their motivations were for abortion. Out of 1,200 abortions that I performed, only two had anything to do with rape and incest. As far, you know, we hear about the life of the mother. Well, there are situations in pregnancy where a pregnancy has to be ended. If a woman has an ectopic pregnancy or a tubal pregnancy, you have to end that pregnancy to save her life. This is not an abortion. This is a separate type of procedure. But we have a lot of controversy going on even in our country about the, you know, claims made all the time how abortion is necessary to save women's lives. This is overstated, and to the public that doesn't understand the fine points, it sounds very convincing. But the reality is that when pregnancy threatens a woman's life, and this can happen, pregnancy can be a very dangerous time for a woman. High blood pressure, cancers, toxemia, out of control heart disease. There are lots of reasons why a pregnancy might threaten her life. What we do is you end the pregnancy. That doesn't mean you end the baby. You just end the pregnancy. You do a delivery. And there are extremely rare circumstances where that would be necessary before that baby is capable of living outside the womb. And not every one of these, you know, these many of these babies are seriously premature. They don't all survive. But a large number of them do. And you work to give them every chance to live. And abortion plays almost no role, especially when you're talking about problems in pregnancy that occur after 20 weeks of gestation, after the halfway point. Because after about, now it varies depending on the level of care, but, you know, even the World Health Organization states now that fetal viability starts at 22 weeks. That's 18 weeks premature. And babies even younger than that have survived on occasion. Having most of the serious problems that come in pregnancy come after viability has been achieved. And you treat them the old-fashioned way. You deliver the patient. You separate her and the baby and then give them both the care they need. Not every child will survive, but many, 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 many of them will.
It's a real difference in philosophy, isn't it, the approach?
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought it was helpful. He acknowledged, you know, that there are dangers, but he just kind of said that, you know, in my experience, you know, abortion is not the solution.
The idea that you deliver the baby, and of course the baby may not survive after delivery, but that's not the same thing as intentionally, ending that life.
Yeah,
is that the thing? Did he comment at all about the mechanics of the abortion regime in Ireland?
Yeah, well, it was sort of, as we were discussing, and particularly when he said plain stay away, you know, his advice to young doctors, it was starting to dawn on me that he wasn't, that he was coming from the perspective of someone who had run a private abortion practice in the US and wasn't fully aware of how abortion is being sort of implemented in Ireland and embedded into the public health system. So I told him that in Ireland the government has proceeded with what a GP-led abortion service, and asked him what he thought of this approach. I think his reaction, and particularly my need to clarify what I meant, was quite striking.
GP-led, meaning your general practitioners?
That's right, yeah. They are treated as the front line, that the government wants all GPs, of course they haven't all agreed to it, but all GPs to be available to provide prescribe abortion pills. And so the Minister for Health wants that rolled out across the country, and the conscientious objection that GPs are permitted is that they do not have to perform the abortion, but they do have to refer to a GP that will provide the abortion. Now, obviously, that's being contested, but that's the model that's being pursued in Ireland.
Wow. So it sounds to me, by promulgating this kind of rule, that your government has essentially made every general practitioner in the country of Ireland an agent of the state. Wow, how do the Irish people feel about that? How would you like to be forced to do something? Well, say you're not, you may not be a physician, but how would you like to be forced by your government to do something that you had an objection to? It's easy. Well, I just refer. Really? I in my career, I do not refer for abortions ever any more than God. You know, imagine for a minute that a patient came to me, and forget legality for a minute, just think ethics and think morals. And a patient came to me and said, you know what, my four-year-old is it's just difficult. It's a pain taking care of her. She consumes so much of my time. She consumes so much of my money. She consumes so much of my effort. I just want to be rid of her. Could you please refer me to someone who would kill my daughter? You wouldn't even think of that. And I guess I said, ignore the legality. Obviously, that's grossly illegal. But ignore the legality of it. Just think of the morals and ethics involved. I and many, many other pro-life obstetrician gynecologists in my country will not refer for abortion. I will not, to me, referring personally. Referring a woman for abortion is no different than the situation I just discussed. Somehow my hands are clean because I send you to someone who will kill your child. I have serious difficulty with that. Many pro-life obstetrician gynecologists in this country do. It's a controversial point. There are some pro-life obstetrician gynecologists who will refer, and it's a matter of conscience. So far in the United States, no one is forcing us to do abortions, and no one is forcing us to refer. And the reason that hasn't happened, and despite this, and statements have come out of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, our professional organization in the state, implying that a doctor is unethical if they won't refer people for abortions. But no one, despite the fact that abortion has been legal here for what now, 46 years, has ever forced a physician to either perform or refer that procedure. So it seems to me that Ireland has jumped way ahead, and I question that as a serious breach of civil liberties. That's my opinion. Of course, I'm an outsider, I understand, but I find that shocking.
You know, it's funny listening to him there. It actually took him a couple of minutes to actually get his breath, because he was almost speechless at the idea that GPs would be forced
to refer,
particularly refer against their value system. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't care what you believe, you're doing this. And the way he was able to say, and it was very clever thinking, actually, imagine any other scenario under which you as a person would be forced by the state to do something that was completely against your conscience. It was amazing. But it took him, he really was, he was floored by your question.
He was percolating. It was dawning on him. I just thought his response was quite honest.
You asked him about abortion pills as well, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I said, you know, following on that, the whole thing of it, you know, a GP-led service, I asked him if he had concerns about abortion pills being prescribed to patients by GPs. When any training they've received would be very recent, you know, it was only introduced in January, straight after the legislation was passed in December, and also where my understanding, people can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding, which is what I told him, is that GPs in general do not have ultrasound equipment, and this is his response.
Well, this would concern me greatly. Sure, anybody can write a prescription and say, here, take these pills. But when you initiate a procedure on a patient, whether it's medical or surgical, you have an ethical duty as a physician to care for any side effects or complications that occur as a result of your treatment of that patient. This is an absolutely rock solid law of medicine. Not a law, but it's our tradition, and it's the way things should be. Is a GP qualified to, what happens when a GP hands out pills and a woman begins to hemorrhage? Heavy bleeding does occur with medication abortions in a certain percentage of the cases, maybe 7 or 8%. What is the GP supposed to do? Oh, well, maybe he'll just dump her into an emergency room. That happens a lot here. You know, abortionists do abortions, but many of them refuse to have hospital privileges because they don't want to deal with the obligations that come with hospital privileges. So if their patients have complications, they simply dump them into emergency rooms, and then whoever happens to be the obstetrician gynecologist on call gets stuck taking care of that patient. And that patient's being cared for by a physician that she's never met because he has no idea what their qualifications are. It is absolutely critical when a medication abortion is started that you are certain that that patient does not have an ectopic pregnancy. If patients have died in this country from using medication to try to initiate a medication abortion on a patient who had an ectopic pregnancy. And the only way I know of ruling out an ectopic pregnancy is to do an ultrasound. They're simply, you know, we're talking in this point in this country of making these things over the counter. This discussion is going on. It has many levels, and it's a complex discussion. But I have serious concerns because is the average general practitioner here, you know, in Ireland or in the United States, really trained to take care of the complications that can and will occur when abortions are performed, either medically or surgically? If, you know, someone, you know, you don't have to be an obstetrician gynecologist, for instance, to learn to do first trimester suction DNC abortions. You could get the training and provide the service if you really want, but you darn well better learn how to take care of the complications and, as a matter of ethics, care for your patients when they come in bleeding or infected or perforated, and be prepared and ready to take care of those complications. I'm seriously concerned when I hear, well, it's no big deal. You're just going to hand out some pills. Oh, isn't that convenient? But what happens when something goes wrong? What happens to the patient? Who takes care of them? To me, it's unethical for a doctor to do that unless they have an existing transfer or referral arrangement with a physician who is skilled to provide the care. So if one of their patients then has a complication, well, you're going to see Dr. So-and-so, who I work with and I trust, and he's going to take care of your problem, as opposed to simply dumping them into emergency rooms. And believe me, that's what's going to happen there, because that's exactly what's happening here.
Yeah, that's it's a fair point, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I was just even listening back to him there earlier on, kind of saying, what does Ireland think about that? The situation we now have in the country, and I think, you know, there's probably a fair bit of going, what have we done, you know, that sort of thing. That you know, this is the regime, this is the arrangement now in place, and as a country, you know, we voted for this. Maybe we didn't know exactly what we voted for. And I was just thinking on my bike on the way in. Just there's a film that I was reminded of. It's called A Few Good Men.
Oh.
You know, we'd be familiar with it. But thinking about that film, ultimately, in a way, it's a bit about it's a bit about conscience. You know, because it's a case where two guys are on trial for carrying out a punishment beating, you know, in a military situation, with orders from the top. And when it's discovered that the orders did come from the top, they're still
liable.
They're still convicted of dishonorable duty and discharge from the army. Yeah. You know, and one of them turns to the other at the end and says, why? You know, we did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
But
But they had.
This is the answer from the other guy. He said, yeah, we did. And you could see in the scene, the realization dawns on him and he says, we were supposed to fight for people who couldn't fight for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And that's what this is about. And, you know, the point is that actually now at the moment, I feel that the pro-life group are in a kind of a shock. They're in a kind of a spasm because it went through. And I think what's actually happening is as everything shakes through, and particularly like you give them an inch and they take a mile, like there's stuff that's been put into law that was never voted on. I'm absolutely convinced of that. That was never really permitted, but you know, by the Constitution. And the constitutional change has allowed it, but the people who voted for them, I'm sure, weren't saying that that's, you know, like if a child is suffering, like for instance, the classic thing I said, you know, if there's a child being aborted and, you know, that we're not allowed to give it pain medication. That's the law now. And it's like, wow. Who could have voted for that? I mean, I tell you, I know who voted for it and I won't be voting for them in the next election, that's for sure. But my point is that, you know, as you know, the pro-life community comes out of that spasm, maybe we'll be able to do something about some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think so, yeah. And certainly, I thought it was very interesting to get the perspective of an outsider.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that shock of him going, they want them to what? It's just amazing. Former abortion doctor Anthony Levitino talking to Steve Johnson. And Steve, thank you for coming in and just breaking it open for us. Thank you so much. Now, it's National Fostering Week, a great opportunity for us to recognise and celebrate the incredible service that is provided by foster carers around the country. And I'm delighted to say I have one on the line from the west of Ireland, Jane Murray. You're very welcome to Spirit Radio. How are you doing there, Jane?
Thanks, Ronan. Great, thank you.
Yeah. So first of all, Jane, tell us your own story. How did you become a foster carer?
It was something I'd considered doing when my older children were very young, and we talked about it and then we'd put it on hold. And it wasn't until my youngest son was born, he was maybe about 3 years old, when the thought occurred to me again, and I spoke to my husband about it, and he said, well, if it's something that interests you, let's look into it and see where it goes. So that's exactly what I did. I started to research and to make contact with people in it was the HSE then, South Tusla. And it just kind of blossomed from there. And we did the training. We went through the whole process. And we've been fostering now for about 8 years.
And was it an easy decision for you and your husband to make? Did you have to kind of throw it around a lot for a long time before you really took the plunge?
You probably should. I'm probably not the best. When I get an idea,
you just go for it. Yeah, fair play. Yeah, that's absolutely.
Now, the process takes time, and that allows you the time to assess where you're going.
Yeah.
So it's not something that happens overnight.
Absolutely. And I know there's a lot of assessing and a lot of...
Yeah.
And you do a course, don't you?
Yes.
Like a training course.
There is a training course provided.
And was that useful?
Yes, it is, but honestly, nothing can prepare you.
No, they can't cover everything, can they?
It's like parenting.
Yeah.
Nothing really prepares you. Yeah. It happens and you find your way.
Absolutely. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm expecting the question the answer is going to be no. So did it turn out to be what you expected, or is there more other stuff along the way?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
It was what I expected in that, you know, the process of fostering. You are prepared to expect the unexpected, and that's absolutely what you get.
Yeah.
Every placement is different, every circumstance is completely different, and you have to work with what you have at the time.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing, evolving process all of the time.
And you know, the idea that, you know, you're dealing with children, were you dealing with particularly small children?
I chose to foster smaller children.
Yeah.
Normally they will look at your family profile.
Yeah.
And they will normally place children younger than your own children.
Yeah, do you know what's really funny? I have a direct experience of this because when we were kids, and I come from a big family, but I was the eldest, and we fostered, you know, and it was short-term fostering placement of somebody, and she was older than me, and there was massive displacement there, you know? And yet, at the same time, I can still see how positive an experience it was, you know, for us all, really, and very much for her as well. So how did your own, speaking of which, how did your own children respond to having foster children in their home?
My children have been exceptional. You know, they've gone above and beyond what could be expected of them, really. And I suppose fostering has brought that out in them.
Yeah.
They have just adapted to life with foster children, and they have completely adapted the children into our family life. So there's never been any conflict or feeling of displacement or anything like that. They have very readily accepted all of our foster children into the family. And having said that, not just my own boys, but my whole family have done that and have been very, very supportive, which is great. And I know that's not always the case.
No, absolutely not.
I have been very lucky.
Yeah. And it's been largely a good experience for you, in the sense that, I mean, I know being an adoptive parent even, but, you know, having had the experience of fostering through my family of origin, as it were, you know, people coming in, they've sad stories, some of them, you know?
Oh, yes. I mean, it can be fairly harrowing, you know, but you have to just take any prejudice you may have and put it aside, because you have to look after the welfare of these little children, and they have to be the absolute priority.
Yeah. Would you say it was rewarding in the long term?
Absolutely. There are huge challenges, and really huge challenges in fostering.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not an easy option.
Sure.
But it presents an opportunity that you would not get doing anything else. So yes, it's absolutely very fulfilling and wonderful to see the growth that the opportunity you give can allow.
Yeah.
But it's hard work as well.
Absolutely.
So you have to balance it all. But
absolutely
fantastic. I love fostering.
Yeah,
I love
you it. Absolutely yeah. love it. Yeah, I can hear from you that you do. Jane, what would your advice be? So somebody who's listening in right now and probably been thinking, you know, that would be your kind of thing. I'm thinking that, and I've just heard Jane talking on the radio. What would your advice be to anyone considering becoming a foster parent?
My advice would be to phone your local TUSLA agency to look into what's involved and follow the process and see where it brings you. And sometimes you just have to go with something. If it's something that's in your head and you're thinking about it, sometimes you just have to go with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And see where it takes you. You won't be pushed into anything. You know, every decision you make along the way is your own.
Yeah.
So go and look into it and see if it appeals to you.
Absolutely. And you know, would you contact your local health board? Do you contact TUSLA? You know.
TUSLA have foster care teams.
Yeah.
And if you Google TUSLA.ie, you should be able to find your local foster care team leader.
Absolutely. Well, Jane Marr, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, and really appreciate you sharing a little bit of your story there with us on this National Fostering Week. It's running all the way from 14th to the 20th of October. God bless you now, and we'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thanks,
great, thanks. Little text in from Sinead. Hi, Ronan, I've just been listening to Steve's interview about abortion. I feel so disillusioned with my country's decision. What can we do? I feel so powerless and overwhelmed about what's going on. The floodgates that have opened are frightening, and things are running away on us. I went to see Unplanned, the movie, on Sunday night, and cried so much during it, but I'm so glad I saw it because I feel more empowered now. We can all do something, no matter how small. We have got to keep praying to God for help and guidance and courage to speak up. Sinead in Limerick, a very grateful member of the supporters team. God bless.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.